One can only appreciate the sea change brought about in 1965 if one understands what happened in 665, in 965, and in 1265. This is one of the fundamental points that I'm going to want to convey in the course of this lecture series. What is not necessarily what was. We could only understand the is if we understand the was. The contemporary world, with all of its nuance and complexity, can only be appreciated if one is aware of important aspects of the medieval world. You expelled us? We're back, and we're still here. The last three or four decades have seen a move to add, quote, early modern to, quote, ancient, medieval, and modern in the list of time periods that for a long time described the trajectory of history. More recently, an argument was made, now quite widely accepted, that the centuries between the 16th and the 18th deserve their own designation. No longer medieval, but not quite yet modern. In 2010, Professor David Ruderman, formerly at the University of Pennsylvania, published a book entitled Early Modern Jewry, subtitled A New Cultural History. Ruderman points in this book to five phenomena that uniquely characterize these centuries, thereby justifying this new designation, relatively new designation, early modern. The first is, quote, an accelerated mobility leading to enhanced contacts between Jews of different backgrounds, traditions, and even languages, and between Jews and non-Jews. The world is now moving. People are traveling. Jews are now traveling with a greater degree of regularity than ever before and come into contact with people with whom they never interacted before. Other kinds of Jews with different backgrounds and also with non-Jews. Horizons are being widened and expanded. The second is, quote, a heightened sense of communal cohesiveness. And Ruderman primarily points to the Council of the Four Lands, the existence of the Vadar Bar Ratzot in Eastern and Central Europe that I described earlier, but not only limited to that. Communities were stronger and were more closely connected. Third, quote, a knowledge explosion precipitated by the technology of the printing press. I spoke about that earlier as well. But not only the printing press, other factors. New technologies bring new realities. There's not just a physical contact, number one, but also a contact through books. Ideas are now more widely understood and connected one to another. The fourth factor is the diminution of rabbinic authority and the limitation of the power of the rabbinic establishment. Rabbis during this time lost much of their power. Whatever power they may have had is now significantly diminished as individual expressions of Judaism become more and more common. This reaches its height, the beginning of the modern period. In fact, this is one of the primary components of the definition of modern, personal autonomy, my own understanding. It's now where individuals become significant, not just corporate structures, but we already have the beginning of this during this early modern period. And the fifth, related to the fourth, is the blurring of religious identities. Different Jews with different ideologies and commitments more and more take a prominent place within various Jewish communities. I'd like to highlight some of these factors in this, my final lecture. Towards the end of the 16th century, I already pointed out, the pendulum of Jewish migration shifted back. Instead of from west to east, it's now from east to west. After having been expelled from Western Europe throughout the Middle Ages, Jews now begin to return to Western Europe. Economically advanced areas there began to feel that Jews, especially those originating from Spain, could be very useful for them. At this point, there are two types of Jews living in Western Europe. First, there were a number of Jews whose parents or grandparents opted to stay in Spain after 1492. And although they had to publicly profess Christianity, that was the only way they could possibly live there at that time, they still persisted in continuing to perform and to practice Jewish rites and rituals clandestinely. You understand what kind of a challenge it was for them living under the Inquisition. But as soon as they could, many of these so-called new Christians left Spain and came to other areas of Western Europe where they still lived as new Christians, where they still continued to profess their Judaism clandestinely and secretly. But now, at this point, circumstances began to change. And little by little, they were now in a position to be able to remove their Christian masks and begin to act publicly as Jews. It became acceptable now to have publicly identifying Jews living in your country. So this is the first category. Secondly, at the end of the 16th century, various West European rulers began to invite clearly identified Jews to return to their kingdoms, Jews who had left Spain, whose ancestors had left Spain, who had always lived as publicly identifying Jews. Now they're also invited to come back into Western Europe. In 1593, for example, Ferdinand, the Grand Duke of Tuscany, invited Jews, both those who came from families that earlier converted to Christianity, as well as those who had always identified as Jews, to come and to settle in his lands. The charter he granted them reads, and I quote, "We grant you the right to traffic and trade in all of the cities, territories, fairs, markets, villages, and other places of our states." Here comes the point of significance. "Under your own names or under a Christian name." There are two categories here. Your own name, your Jewish name, your Hebrew name, or under your Christian name. Holland gained independence from Spain in 1583, and new Christians who had been living there threw off the mask, began identifying as Jews, and they were joined by other always having been professing Jews. This is the case in Italy, this is the case in France and elsewhere. Sephardi Jews were the first to move westward. The oldest synagogues today in London and Amsterdam are Sephardic synagogues. The Beavis Mark Synagogue in London, you can go and visit, beautiful, and the Esnoga in Amsterdam, also incredibly beautiful. The oldest synagogue in Hamburg was also Sephardic, but that was destroyed by the Nazis. Only later were the Sephardim joined by Ashkenazim, who are making their way out of Eastern and Central Europe. And it is, frankly, at this time, not for discussion here, when Jews began to arrive in America. And so by the second half of the 17th century, the Sephardi diaspora in Western Europe consists of two groups. One, the descendants of those who originally moved there still with a new Christian identity, who lived all along publicly identified as Christians, but now were free to identify as Jews. And second, the descendants of those who chose to be exiled from Spain, always maintained their Jewish identity. Now they're welcome back as publicly professing, identifying Jews into these areas. But then there was a third category, and it is to this category that I want to draw our attention, I find this to be most fascinating, surprising, and frankly inspiring. There were many new Christians who stayed in Spain and continued to stay in Spain and lived as Christians in Spain for two generations, for three generations, for four generations, for two centuries. And now that Western Europe was beginning to open up for Jews, they decided 200 years later to leave Spain and to move to Western Europe where they could live openly as Jews. It's remarkable. They lived in Spain for all this time as Christians. And yet all this time they maintained an subterranean, internal, private, individual Jewish identity at great personal risk, you understand. Had they been discovered by the Inquisition, they would have been burnt at the stake. And amazingly, they were able to transmit their Jewish identity in secret to children, to grandchildren, for generation after generation. You understand what this challenge is. At which point are you going to tell your child that she or he is Jewish? If they're too young, they're not going to appreciate what you just told them, and then they're going to go to their Christian school, they're going to blurt out, oh my God, I can't believe what Daddy told me last night, that we're Jews. And that would be the end. That would be horrifically dangerous. Are you going to wait until they're more mature, until they're too old? So it's too late. They already have a strongly, fully formed Christian identity, and they're just going to reject you. So when are you going to be able to successfully transmit this in a way that will be meaningful and also not dangerous? This was the challenge, and yet somehow they were able to meet this challenge. Two, three, four generations. Circumcision was obviously out of the question. Sabbath and holiday observance, possible only clandestinely and at great risk. But yet, in spite of these formidable, hard to imagine challenges, many Jews were successful in keeping alive the flame of Judaism in their families, generation after generation after generation. Very interestingly, we know that the most important day of the entire Jewish calendar for these Jews was a day that generally is considered to be relatively minor, and that is the fast of Esther. The fast of Esther for them looms very large, takes place on the day before the holiday of Purim. The Esther story was their story, a woman who was living surrounded by a powerful non-Jewish society, afraid to reveal her identity as a Jew. They deeply identified with Esther. Passover, it's biblical. Holiday of Tabernacles, Sukkot, biblical. The fast of Esther, it's important, but in the scheme of things, not that important. But for them, this observance was catapulted to the top of their priorities because her story was their story. The challenges they faced to maintain some or even a tiny sense of Jewish identity were enormous, but yet they were successful. And now, 200 years later, great-grandchildren are prepared to leave Spain, also at great personal risk, to rejoin their co-religionists living public Jewish lives in Western Europe. And so we have three groups. We have new Christians who came as new Christians and slowly began to identify as Jews. We have Jews who had always identified as Jews. And now we have Jews who lived in Spain, whose great-great-grandparents lived in Spain, but somehow all these years later felt something that was pulling them to see if there's any way that they could possibly live publicly as Jews in a Jewish community. But now imagine for a moment the challenges that they experienced when they entered into, for example, Amsterdam, the already flourishing and robust Jewish community. To describe it as a culture shock is an understatement. You understand that their Judaism, the one that they were accustomed to for 100, 150, 200 years in the Iberian Peninsula, was biblical Judaism. That's pretty much all they knew. There is evidence that they may have known a little bit here and there in Spanish translation, but basically their religion was biblical. And now they come to Amsterdam and they're confronted with a rabbinic Judaism that's practically very different than the Judaism to which they were accustomed from the Bible. Men now needed to be circumcised, couples remarried in Jewish ceremonies, and they brought their children born to them in their previous lives under the marriage canopy, under the chuppah, somehow, quote, legitimizing them. This was actually a technical term that was used to describe this phenomenon. Many of them who arrived performed a series of acts and rituals, literally rites of passage, which could not help but impress upon them that in reclaiming their new spiritual patrimony, they were beginning a new life. Many felt guilty about their previous lives and engaged in all kinds of self-imposed penitential rites and rituals, ranging from observing private fasts to actually undergoing flogging. And it's amazing how many of them were able to integrate into the Jewish community at that time, but sometimes there could not but be challenges. Some former new Christians who now wanted to rejoin the Jewish community could not find their places in what they experienced as a most strange and alien Jewish environment. Take Uriel da Costa, for example. He was born Gabriel da Costa in Portugal in 1585 to a new Christian family whose father was a devout Catholic. I want to use him as an example of the tensions, the complexity of this transition. In his autobiography written years later, da Costa wrote that studying the Bible in Spain is what brought him back to and close to his Jewish roots. And he converted to Judaism as he understood it to be from the Bible. He and his family then fled to Amsterdam to freely practice their newly adopted Jewish faith. But there he discovered how his version of Judaism was very different than the one that was practiced by the community. He criticized his new co-religionists for what he considered to be too rigid and too ritualistic in practice of Judaism, and he wrote a book that was presenting his perspective. For that, he was excommunicated, arrested, and fined, and his book was burned. This simply could not fly. This couldn't happen in that community. The community could not abide such a criticism and such a rejection. However, missing the sense of community that he craved, he sought reconciliation and he came back and he rejoined the synagogue. But his doubts persisted. He stopped observing Jewish practices and once again he was excommunicated. But once again, he can't stand alone and he rejoins the community, publicly recanted his heretical views. He received 39 lashes, prostrated himself that the whole entire congregation could step on him, but he still couldn't do it, and at the end, he committed suicide. Da Costa's story is a tragic one, a terribly tragic one, but I understand it. I empathize with those who sacrificed their worlds for a Judaism as they understood it to be, only to be confronted by an entirely different version of that religion to which they could not be reconciled. I would note that this early modern experience serves as a precedent for the experience of Ethiopian Jews in our day. When Ethiopian Jews began arriving in Israel in the 1990s, where they were reunited with the mainstream of world Jewry, theirs too, what they brought with them, was a biblical Judaism. For some 2,000 years, they were pious and sincere Jews, totally committed to the Judaism that they understood it to be. And upon their arrival in the State of Israel in the 1990s, they confronted an entirely different version of Jewish ritual practice. Imagine how they felt after having been totally committed to their understanding of Judaism for 2,000 years, to be told that they're not authentic Jews, and they needed, for example, to undergo conversion. I understand why they were told that, but I also empathize with their reaction. Once again, we need the was to appreciate the is. We need to appreciate the historical precedent of returning conversos, or new Christians, and with that we can better appreciate the difficulties these Ethiopian Jews encountered in acculturating into a new world. This is my basic principle. I come back to it again and again, and once more in my final presentation. We cannot really understand and fully appreciate the present unless we understand and appreciate the past. A century later, after da Costa, Baruch or Benedictus Spinoza, more famous Dutch philosopher of Portuguese Sephardic origin, also came from this world. He also had difficulty figuring out a way how to incorporate and integrate himself into the rabbinic establishment of Amsterdam, and he was also excommunicated and buried in a Christian cemetery in The Hague. Once again, we have to ask the right question. I've said this often, and I say it again. For me, the question is not how a da Costa or a Spinoza could emerge. For me, the question is, why were there not more da Costas or Spinozas? It's remarkable to me that so many Jews were able to make this transition and somehow figure out a way to integrate into their new communities. And so we have come to the end of our story. The next chapter would focus on emancipation, enlightenment, the rise of Hasidism, religious reform, the implication of, quote, modernity, the power of the individual, but I will leave that to others to explore. In the time that we have spent together, I hope I have succeeded. I've certainly tried to succeed in conveying the drama, the majesty, and the significance of the medieval Jewish story through focusing on central trends, major events, great debates, and influential figures of the time, and I hope you understand exactly each of these categories. I have analyzed Jewish life under Christianity and Islam in the Middle Ages. I've outlined some of the major elements of Jewish intellectual history of this time. I've traced the movement of Ashkenazi and Sephardi Jews from west to east, from Western Europe into Eastern Europe and the Ottoman Empire. And I hope I have made the case that this matters. This matters to all thoughtful and engaged people living in the first part of the 21st century. We need to understand and appreciate the was to understand and appreciate the is. I started my first lecture with the story of the prospective proselyte and the sage Hillel, first Shammai, who said, I'm not teaching you the whole Torah while you're standing on one foot, it's ridiculous. Comes to Hillel. Hillel says, okay, here it is. In a nutshell, the rest is commentary. And I've tried to share my tension of trying to convey the whole Torah of medieval Jewish life while standing on one foot. But I want to conclude now with another story. It's a story about a mother-in-law who bought two ties for her son-in-law. She's happy to give them to him. He's happy to receive them. The next day, he's so proud, he comes in and he's wearing one of the ties. And his mother-in-law says, what's the matter? You didn't like the other tie? That's what I feel like. There's so much material, and I can only choose a part of it. I could only focus on a piece of it. And undoubtedly, I left out an enormous amount. And it's hurtful to me. I've spent decades studying medieval Jewish history. And to put it all into 10 short lessons or sessions or lectures, I have found to be extremely challenging. And so I urge you, continue your studies, enhance your knowledge, be inspired to learn more about the extraordinary heritage that is Judaism's and that continues to play a most important role in the world today. Thank you.